Welcome to a new episode of the China Flexpat podcast. And today we have Jeff, who is VIP on LinkedIn with 3 million followers. So I'm really impressed by his work, especially as he comes from the US and he made a career in the last 25 years by traveling around the world and working in different industries, always learning himself while he's also teaching others like me. So with this, welcome Jeff.
Yeah, my name is Jeff Towson. I'm basically a consultant, investor, professor focused on one question, which is basically digital strategy. Digital companies, why they win, how they win. And they're in China, Asia, US, all over the world. That's kind of my niche.
Jeff, why did you first decide to come to China?
That was a little bit random. I was based in New York, but for many years I'd been working out of the Middle East for a Saudi prince named Al Waleed, who was a very global businessman. And so I was kind of had a foot in the developing economies, and they sent me to China initially to look at a project. And you know, eventually I just ended up staying there. I was comfortable in developing economies, and China, Asia, I thought was the most exciting developing economy to focus on.
But why did you switch to taking the role as a professor?
That I kind of did along the way. After I finished working for this fairly famous guy where you couldn't say anything. I mean, you couldn't say anything. And then after I left, I started writing books, teaching a little bit at the side, on the side, first at Cambridge Business School and then at Peking University, just sort of adjunct, you know, a class. And that just kind of grew from there over about 10 years where, you know, suddenly you're teaching 3 to 4 courses, you're writing books and, you know, step by step.
And how would you compare the two challenges, being like an investment banker with a very superior boss, very well known, and then going into the teaching industry where you teach your know-how and you work with different students? And how would you compare the two professions?
Well, I mean, I was never a banker. I was a management consultant out of New York. So it's sort of the Booz Allen, BCG, McKinsey route through life. And that's when you end up working for, let's say, a billionaire. You're doing analysis. This company's a good idea. This one went bust. What are we going to do about it? So that's not quite the same path, but it is somewhat related to deal development and things like that. And then you're basically, and now today I mostly do consulting and then sort of some investing, but it's all the same thing. It's all just thinking. You're analyzing things, you're thinking, and writing is pretty much how I think. If I don't write something, I don't really know it. So you're writing reports for your boss, you're writing articles, you're writing a lecture. You know, I'm in the thinking business at the end of the day. I don't run anything. I'm a terrible operator. I'm a terrible executive.
I get that. But what I really like is how you analyze and how you let your audience follow your thoughts. So how do your students react to this? And do you see a difference in students from different geographies, from the US and from China, Thailand, and wherever you have experience?
Yeah, the trick with whether it's teaching or podcasting or, you know, giving keynotes or whatever, the only way you can, the biggest screw up in my experience that I've done is if you're talking below the level of the audience, where they're like, we know this, that's obvious, that really annoys people. So you have to always talk at the highest level of the audience, right? The smartest person in the room, that's your level. Now with MBA students, which is mostly what I teach, okay, they're a lot lower than executive MBAs, and they're lower than giving a talk to, you know, 200 hedge fund managers in New York. Okay, that group is really smart. Right, so you got to sort of tier the level that you're sort of coming in at. That's probably the only screw-ups I've ever made is when I've talked below the level of the room.
But have you ever had the feeling that you talk above the level, that people don't follow you, they don't understand, and they get frustrated?
Yeah, that can be a problem. They generally get frustrated, but they don't get angry at you. MBAs, it's a little, I mean, if you're dealing with hedge fund managers, the burden's on you because they know everything. And if you're a management consultant talking with CEO of a retailer in Brazil or whatever, you have to tell that person something they don't know about their own business. Like, that's a very high bar to clear. So that's, you know, that's one challenge. When you deal with MBAs, they can get a little frustrated if they get lost. MBAs in China, pretty voracious. Pretty aggressive. They kind of are used to the idea that they're going to be pushed very hard. you know, a lot of reading, a lot of thinking quickly. They're kind of used to it. If you're teaching in Thailand or the U.S., they can sometimes get very not resentful, but you have to slow down a little bit sometimes, because if they feel lost, it's frustrating for them. China, they're kind of expected to put their nose to the grindstone. They're very used to it. So I've had that problem in other places, never in China.
That's really interesting. So what would be your advice to people like me who lead Chinese teams? How can I close the gap between them and me? And how can I talk on this level, which is always above their ability, and not frustrate them at the same time?
Yeah, I've never had a problem with that in China. In my experience, whether it's a company or whatever, they're just worse used. Like their previous bosses, who are probably Chinese, always pushed them harder than me. I've never been more than other people they've experienced, generally. Maybe I'm at the same level, maybe I'm below. I've never been more. There's a lot of really super aggressive people in the mainland.
So how did your professor role, how did this open doors for you in the private industry to do consulting work?
Generally, it hasn't. It's a secondary, it's just a different objective. You know, if you're a professor, fine, there's a million professors out there. In China, it's a little bit different, because if you're a professor at Peking University or Tsinghua, that is actually kind of a big deal. You know, people will buy you lunch if you're in a city somewhere and you mention that, right? That's pretty unusual. Like, that doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. In my experience, what matters is thought leadership. If you're an academic, a PhD, you're publishing journals that really only other academics read. I don't do that. If you're going for thought leadership in industry, okay, then you're writing articles at McKinsey and you're speaking at Keene. That's a different playbook. You can get there in a lot of routes. You can be a professor. It doesn't help you that much. You can write books. You can do podcasts now. And you know, it's a free-for-all. So I don't think it really matters. I think if you want to be a professor, be a professor. It's a good thing to do with some of your time. It doesn't hurt you, but it probably doesn't help you that much in terms of industry.
And how about your books and your podcasts? How does that open doors for consulting work?
Yeah, that's pretty powerful. I think most professionals, lawyers, venture capitalists for sure, that you can build a tremendous reputation online now that you simply could not do 10 years ago. And I was pretty early on this. Venture capitalists, you know, they've all got articles and podcasts now, and, you know, so do like, you know, BCG and McKinsey and law firms. They're putting out this stuff all the time now. Thought leadership, where people really, if you're doing a 1 hour podcast, people really know what level you're at pretty quickly. You can't talk for hours without people, you know, people kind of seeing, okay, this person's pretty good, but they're not. I mean, it's pretty obvious. And you can build a global reputation. I mean, it's pretty powerful. It used to be in the past you couldn't do that. You could be senior partners at, let's say, McKinsey, who I deal with quite a bit, who have unbelievable knowledge. Nobody besides their clients had any idea who they were. But they could be the greatest thinkers in auto on the planet. Their clients knew that, but nobody else did. Now you can.
And how did you use LinkedIn for this journey? I'm so impressed. 3 million followers. I have 10,000, not even. So how did you manage that? And how does it help you?
Yeah, that's a bit of a quirk. If you're going to get a lot of followers online, you've got to be good at what you do, no question, right? You got to be in the top 5 to 10% of thinkers in your subject. Okay, that's not going to get you out of the bell curve. Getting out of the bell curve has a lot to do with just timing. You know, these social media platforms, if you were early on YouTube, those people rocketed up. If you were early on podcasting, that's Joe Rogan. You know, Mr. Beast was early on YouTube. I was very early on LinkedIn when they started to do content and focusing on Asia in particular. And I was really one of the few people out there in China who was putting up content for a good 2 years. And now it's congested. Now there's content everywhere. And, you know, you have followers, but the traffic and engagement, these platforms, like, you got to catch them on the upslope. But once they get congested, you know, you don't get the engagement. So I'm not getting engagement like I was 4 years ago. It's just the nature of the animal. You don't want to play this game of I need a million followers. What you want to play the game is I have 10,000 followers who read everything I do. That's what you really want. If you have 10,000 hedge fund managers who read everything you do, that's incredibly valuable. That's really the game you want to play. The other stuff, the big hits, that comes and goes. But it's mostly about timing. Yeah, it's 50% about timing.
You talk about thought leadership and being visible. And how are you visible to the Asian consumers? I wouldn't say they're very active on LinkedIn. So how do you reach them?
Well, there's China and there's Asia. And then there's cross-border. It used to be, LinkedIn, their content sharing is no longer happening in China, right? That's been shut down. But I was never really focused on that. If you're a foreigner in China, which I am, you know, the best position is always to be cross-border. So I explain China to people in Europe, the US, Latin America, Brazil, a lot of focus on China. That's a better position than trying to be a person telling Chinese about China. You can do it, but there's a lot more competition. There's not that many people who can explain China to the rest of the world. Much smaller number of people who can do that. So I always tell people, you want one foot in, one foot out. If you have both feet in, your competition goes up by a factor of 1,000.
And you teach in countries where you're not a native. So you have the FlexPad topic written all over your face. So how do you do this? How do you differentiate from local professors or from local consultants who understand the market where you're currently competing?
Yeah, that's a big deal. I was in Brazil like 4 months last year. And okay, there's digital thinkers in Brazil. There's consultants in Brazil who do digital transformation. There's professors. Why would they wait for me to fly in from Asia? Well, I'm going to come in and tell them about what the leading companies of China are doing in digital retail. Alibaba, JD, ByteDance. Okay, nobody there knows that stuff. So it all works out fine. But if I come in and say, look, I'm going to tell you about how to do basic retail strategy in Brazil, we got people here who know that. So you kind of got to make those jigsaw pieces line up. Being cross-geographic is generally a harder strategy than just being the guy who lives in Berlin who knows everything about Berlin real estate and has been doing it for 10 years. It is a disadvantage in many ways to be cross-border. So you've got to have a compensating advantage. You know, retail in Brazil is getting digitally transformed. They're freaked out knowing what's kind of come next out of Asia, like Shopee or TikTok, which is a big deal in Brazil. That's a compensating advantage for the fact that I'm probably going to be at a disadvantage versus locals. That's how I think about it.
What is your advice to FlexPads, how to bridge the markets, to explain to other countries how China works and to Chinese how the international world works?
Yeah, it's always two questions. What does the customer or reader deeply care about? Not a little bit care about, not a like, ooh, that's kind of interesting. It's got to be a 10 out of 10 in their radar because there's too much stuff in the world, right? You got to be something they absolutely need or love. If it's a 5 out of 10, don't do it. It's got to be a 9 out of 10 in terms of the impact on the user. Question number two is, what can I do that other people can't do? You do not want to be a foreigner going into China and saying, I'm going to write about real estate because there's literally tens of millions of people who do that. But if I'm writing about digital companies, Alibaba, those sorts of companies, to investors all over the world, well, there's not that many people who can do that. If you haven't spent 10 years on the ground in China, how are you really going to understand this stuff? Reading reports out of New York? Good luck. So I like that cross-border aspect because I have a clear answer to both questions. Now, don't do anything with China if you don't have a clear advantage. Because otherwise, if you don't have an advantage, it all comes down to who's smart and who works hard. Well, everybody's smart in China and everybody works hard. So you don't want to play that game at all.
This topic with the unfair advantage, what you describe as moats. So how can you build such a moat for your own career as a professional based or working with China?
Well, moats are a very specific thing about business structures. You know, Alibaba has a moat, Amazon has a moat. Those are sort of structural advantages, which, I've written 6 books on this subject for digital businesses. Nobody ever wanted to read 6 books about this but me and maybe my mom, but I don't think she actually read them. When you talk about your career, okay, you're not talking about moats, you're just talking about an advantage. You know, can you have an advantage as a writer of current events? Not really, not anymore. Anyone with a laptop can do it. And now ChatGPT is making freaking everybody can do it. Can you have an advantage as an investigative reporter, digging up information that others don't know? Yeah, that's pretty good. Can you know more? Can you explain? I had a student once who was from Norway. He spent some time in China, got his MBA, went back to Norway. You know, very few people in Oslo really understand business in China, and yet there's a huge amount of resource relationships there, Germany. So you can be one of very few people in Italy in particular, Germany, who have a lot of business ties with China. You can be one of the few people on the ground that really understand that stuff. So when you think about your career, you got to have an answer to that question. It just makes life easier. Oftentimes, here's the easiest answer. The easiest way to have an advantage is to be first. Be the person right now who understands ChatGPT and generative AI, as opposed to the person who understands standard marketing, because that's been around forever. If you get there early, you're halfway home.
And Jeff, how do you do this yourself? You go around the planet and teach and consult and so on. So how do you build your own moat for your own personal brand?
I'm mostly living on personal brand. You have to think about what business you're in. In some businesses, everybody can play. And in some businesses, if you're not in the top three, you're done. You can be a dentist in any town. You can always find some patients, but you can't be another social media company. If you weren't in the top three, you're done. Okay, what I do, consulting, advisory, all that, there's companies all over the world. Yeah, I'm in Brazil a lot. I'm in Germany a lot. I'm in China a lot now. I mean, it's fine. You know, how much of an advantage you have, you got to ask, is this a winner-take-all game or not? Or can everyone kind of play? If you're a pretty good dentist in a town, you're going to do fine. I'm kind of in that bucket. The flip side to that argument is most of the games that if you want to scale and become very, very large, they tend to be winner-take-all. What I do doesn't scale dramatically, but I can always do that. I can always find, you know, clients anywhere. And I do stuff partly for money, which is important. Oftentimes I just do it because it's really interesting. If I get a really cool question or a client, I'll go, you know, just because it's a lot of it's personal interest. Lifestyle's part of that for me in a way it's not for a large corporation. I'm not building against the biggest market trends. No, I'm building against a personal network where I know people. You know, that's my market, is my professional network. Then I know executives in this country or that country. You know, easy way to do this, if you want to build, let's call it maybe not a lifestyle business, but it's definitely not a corporate strategy. A guy like me, and there's a lot of decent folks like me, you really need three assets. You need a reputation as a leading thinker in your field, and it's got to matter. You need a professional network. That's where most of your contacts are going to come from. You need to be building that network. You need to build your reputation every day. You need to build your network every day. And then in theory, it helps you if you have a body of work. Books, articles, past client engagements. Those are the three assets. And you want those to be increasing every week, and you get stronger and stronger. But you got to have the professional network. People don't think about that one.
You must have like a real high amount of discipline, how you create content and get it out there, how you understand new technologies, how do you research? Do you have like a team, or do you have people working for you? How do you do this to create so much content?
Yeah, I'm more of a lifestyle business, I suppose. I have teams that I work with. I have people that I bring in. I have a network. But I'm definitely not building I want to build a big firm. I don't want to do that. I've done that. I don't do anything I wouldn't do for free, right? So I'm really interested in this subject. It's my favorite thing to do, right? If it's Saturday, this is what I get up and do. And this is an easy way to figure out if you have something like this, which most people don't. What do you do on a Saturday when no one's paying you? Well, for me, there's no difference between Saturday and the rest of the week. Most people, if you ask them what that is, they don't have an answer. It's an exception, which is fine. Nothing wrong with that. So yeah, I sort of write and speak and get into my subject because it's my favorite thing to do in life. And then I've built multiple businesses against that, but I don't do anything that takes me out of that. If someone says, here's a great project, let's go do this, it's on a different subject, I don't do it. So this is not necessarily a career path that other people should follow, the idea of do what you love. If you have that, it's unbelievable, but probably only about 10% of people. Other people, you should do what's smart. My brother's a dentist, great business, good lifestyle. He likes his work. If he's not getting paid, he's probably not showing up 5 to 7 days a week. I still do.
Were you always like really interested in what you do?
No, it took me half my career to find my thing. So I was at business school and medical school at the same time. I went into management consulting, which is a natural next step. And then spent years there, and it was fine. It was a job. It was good. Flying around the U.S. back home to Midtown Manhattan, doing client projects. Fine. It was a good job. didn't mean any too much to me, but I liked my people. It was fun. It was, I liked my colleagues, all of that. And then I worked for the Saudi billionaire. Exciting, fun. But again, this is, I wouldn't do it if I wasn't getting paid. And then eventually within all that, I found my subject and I just started writing and thinking about digital strategy. And yeah, that was the big changeover. And then once you find that, which most people don't, which is totally fine, you find it unbearable to go and do work that doesn't mean anything to you anymore. So I literally, I can't do the other stuff anymore. All I want to do is my writing and digital strategy and read my annual reports. Yeah, I didn't get there till about halfway through my career.
Can you try to let us understand a little bit how you found this and what is your advice for FlexPeds to find this, to look for this and find it?
Generally, I ask my students, how many of you have something you love to do? You're just obsessed with it. You do it every day. And it's usually about 8 to 10% of hands go up. And that's normal. Most people, they don't get obsessed with something. They have a nice balanced life. They have a good career that they enjoy. They have family. They have friends. They have, maybe they teach on the side. That's most people. And that's totally fine. And in that strategy, you should be smart about it. Tax attorneys enjoy their life immensely and they enjoy their profession, but nobody's obsessed with tax law. No, it's the profession and the colleagues and all of that together. You know, folks like me are kind of rare. If you do find it, it's great. Otherwise, I'd say be smart and balance those things out. Work, have a good lifestyle and see your family and all of that. I don't think people like me are necessarily the goal. If you find it, you'll know. You don't need me to tell you. You'll know. 10 p.m. on Saturday, I'm reading annual reports about digital companies. That's not normal.
Jeff, what would you say, what are you really thankful for what happened in your career which got you to where you're today?
The smart move to do is to follow the beaten path. Go to the right school, get an entry-level job, banking, whatever, follow the path. That is very, very smart. If you're going to wander off the path, like I have, there's trade-offs there. You know, you got to know what they are. For me, it followed a lot from personality, and I suspect a lot of your folks, your FlexPats, it's the same, that it was just such an interesting thing to do, that there was an adventure to it. I'm going to live in China. I'm going to live in Beirut and fly in on the jet to Riyadh. There was an adventurous quality to it. And sometimes that's just the driving force. That when I look back, you know, that's what matters to me now, that there was just sort of a very adventurous life. And I still got a long way to go, so I'm going to keep going. When I compare that to spending 20 years in Midtown Manhattan, doing client work, I couldn't do it, even though I think that's a good life, just not for me.
So this sounds like the free dream, the living your dream, working the way that you really enjoy. But what's the downside for this? So do you need to have like financial independence in order to have such a life, or can you just take the risk even when you're young?
The problem you have when you're younger is the opportunity cost. The years you are traveling around the world or doing whatever, you are not rising up from associate to vice president to junior partner at BCG. You play a tremendous opportunity cost for that. Because a lot of those pathways are only at a certain stage of your career. You can only enter it. You can't come in later and say, I want to be a junior associate, right? I think that's a good way to think about it, because I did this traditional route for a long time. So I benefited from that. And I also learned my skills. If you're going to kind of do more of a flexible thing, your probability of failure goes up if you don't have some, you know, you haven't put the years in. Like, I know how to do consulting for years, and I knew how to do this stuff before I sort of went off the path. So I don't think, and then the financial bit's part of it, but I think more it's you want to build your skill set and credibility and expertise. That's probably the big trade-off, and you got to get that in your back pocket. Then if you go off and do something, you can come back, right? I could go back to a traditional consulting firm and call them up, say, hey, it'd be fine. That's probably the thing to think about if you're younger.
So be smart in your 20s and then bold in your 40s, is that right?
If you're smart and you keep your nose to the grindstone in your 20s and you stay on the path, you will have lots and lots of options open up to you when you get a little older in life. And part of that's financial, you got some money to make, but you've also got skills, you've got clients, and you may decide, which a lot of people did, which I did, you know, you're sort of looking at, do I want to become a partner at one of these, you know, firms? That's a commitment to 10 years. And I really knew I didn't want to do that. But I did the training up until that point. Yeah, that's probably the way to do it. you want to be sensible, right? You do. And then as you get older, you can. But what happens a lot of people is they also have families and things, and that will also limit your ability to move around, which is fine. It's good. So, you know, all these things sort of play out.
Jeff, what could something be which makes you go back home? Something which happens, so whatever, and you just say, okay, I have to go back. I go back to the US and I'll have to settle myself.
Yeah, there's kind of a process to this, which is funny. Like what most people do, like me, and I think it's common, is you go abroad as almost like a tour of duty. You know, you're based in New York. I was working at a company and they send you abroad on a project, right? And it's a project. And then that's sort of step one. And then step two is when you start doing more and more work overseas and maybe you start to get a home there. Oh, now I'm based in Beijing, but I still have my home in New York, which is what I did. That's step two. And then step three is when you let go of the home in New York. And you're like, oh, I guess I don't really live in the US anymore. Okay. That's what happened to me. I mean, I could go back. I don't really feel like I probably ever will. I'll do projects everywhere. So that's different, right? I'm moving around a lot. But no, I haven't had my home in the US in 5 years. And I don't think I'll have it again.
It sounds a lot like me. I can totally relate to everything you shared today. And I really enjoy how you explain this today in a way that everybody can follow. So this is what we do in this podcast as well, to really set the benchmark for this international working style, flexpat working style, exactly like you just explained it. And some people are ready to this and some people are not. Is there something what you would like to leave the audience with, some message that you think they should know if they're working just like you, international, in China or in Asia?
You never know how to put together the pieces. You want to put together the truth is you're going to discover all this along the way and then look back and go, oh, now the pieces fit. So as you're sort of in the process, you know, my best default strategy is just follow the smartest people you know. You know, if you don't know what to do after so-and-so school or whatever, where are all the people you really respect doing? Oh, they're all going into venture capital. Okay, maybe that's a good idea. The wisdom of the crowd. Don't rely on your own brain to figure everything out. Look at 10, 20 people you really respect, see what they're all doing. If you do that, what you'll find is you'll get more and more opportunities as you go. If you go down the wrong path, you can often find yourself sort of stuck. Oh, I don't want to be here, but I don't know what to do next. So the wisdom of the crowd, not a bad idea.
Jeff, on the China Flexpat podcast, and I'll put all your books and stuff in the show notes, so I really hope that our audience can follow you as well. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And that's it. Thank you so much for tuning into the China Flexpat podcast again. It was such a pleasure to talk to Jeff, who I've been following for many years. He was such an inspiration. I just can recommend you to find someone like this who you follow and who you can learn from. Jeff was talking about the wisdom of the crowd. So why not follow the wisdom of the Flexpat crowd and check out the other episodes about consulting and career development who we have listed in the show notes. Just check them out. And as always, please leave us a positive review on your podcast app. Give us a like and a comment on LinkedIn. And you can always reach out to me directly and let me know what you would like to learn about or how you want to contribute to the community. We are all flexpats, we all want to grow, and we can use your help.